car and a boat. Things got bad, now the boat won't float. I don't like it. I'm too proud to be born. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working. We're not a working. We're just not working anymore. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working
This hour program is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Chenny Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon in Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjwj.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WFT and Decatur attorney Bill Favor, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Favor proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, the GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice, both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WFT Community Radio. Okay, welcome to the World Labor Hour, brought to you there by listener-supported community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois at 90.1 FM and webcast live worldwide at WEFT.org. Views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Okay, we're going to be having some news stories at the top of the hour, and we've got a special guest here live in the studio that we'll introduce you to briefly. And also, we're going to be having a call-in guest at 12 noon. Our show's going to be going beyond the 12 o'clock hour this week. And anyway, it'll be Sean O'Terrain. He's an Irish political activist and author. So like I said, he'll be calling in at 12 noon, and we're going to be talking about a lot of different things today. So I guess news of the week. Gus, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I got two stories, Dave. One more Illinois. Well, both of them actually about Illinois. The first one is the most recent story that happened yesterday. The violent clash at the Trump rally.
That was in Chicago. Okay,
yes, in Chicago. Needless to say, what happened was is that you had the community, the South Side community, the everyday working people, the local people that actually organized themselves to protest the Trump's visit to Chicago. And what happened was is that Trump supporters started agitating the crowd and started actually assaulting the members of the community. So the community members, of course, defended themselves, and it led to Trump saying he's going to cancel the rally, et cetera, and moving on. But what I want the listeners out there to know is that violence has followed Trump's rallies throughout the country. I found a very good piece that actually breaks down the issues with Trump's rallies, and this is not something that is sporadic or new. So on this past Wednesday at a rally near Fayetteville, North Carolina, a supporter of Trump attacked a 26-year-old black man, Rakeem Jones, as he was being escorted out of the Crown Coliseum by Cumberland County Sheriff deputies. Jones was one of a small group of anti-Trump protesters at the event, peaceful protesters that were attacked by pro-Trump protesters. The attacker was 78-year-old John McGraw. He punched Jones in the face, knocking him down. Afterwards, McGraw boasted of the attack. He told a television interviewer, quote, "You bet I liked it. He deserved it. The next time we see him, we might have to kill him. He might be with a terrorist organization," end quote. And that, so again, these are Trump supporters, mind you. Now,
you know what I don't like?
Yeah.
Is that guy had a ponytail? I'm sick of these rednecks co-opting my hippie history. It's disgusting.
Yeah,
as Trump would say, it's disgusting.
Oh, I got some Trump quotes for you now. At a press conference Friday morning, right before the issues of yesterday morning, in Palm Beach, Florida, Trump defended the attack, blaming it on the victim. Quote, "It was a guy who was swinging, was very loud, and then started swinging at the audience. And you know what? It swung back, and I thought it was very, very appropriate," end quote. So the attack in North Carolina was followed by physical confrontations between Trump supporters and some of the thousands of protesters who attended a planned Trump rally in Chicago Friday evening. The event was called off after the last minute. Earlier this week, Michelle Fields, a reporter for the right wing, for some right wing websites and news outlets, tried to approach Trump after a Florida rally campaign, after a Florida rally, and campaign manager Corey Lewandowski grabbed her by the arm and shoved her away, an assault witnessed by several journalists. So these incidents follow a pattern in which protesters at or outside Trump's rallies have been physically attacked by Trump supporters, including members of white supremacist groups and Trump security guards, or forcibly ejected by police. Last week, a young black woman who brought an anti-Trump sign to a rally was attacked physically and cursed with racist and sexist language. Her sign was ripped up and she was literally thrown out of the rally. So again, and if you want to, there's more, I don't want to take up time, too much time on this, but there has literally been an incident every week in regards to a Trump rally where Trump supporters have physically assaulted people in the rally spaces.
Mm-hmm. I got a little time to take up on this. Anyway, my sister and Rachel Maddow both figured out that Trump did set the situation up in Chicago on purpose. Okay, here's the thing. I don't normally watch Rachel Maddow, but it popped up on my Facebook page this morning and watched a whole bunch of video and heard a lot of reports from reporters. And basically one reporter said that the crowd was 60% anti-Trump.
Yes, that's what I saw too.
And here's what the reasoning is. First, it was announced that the appearance was going to take place a week ahead of time. So that gave people plenty of time to organize counter protests.
Yep.
Okay. Another one is he spoke in St. Louis that afternoon and said that the police there had told him that maybe he should not have his appearance there. And he said, "Oh no, argle bargle." And, then he claimed that the police told his campaign that he should cancel. The Chicago Police Department says we didn't contact his campaign at all. And it has all the appearances of being a setup to make people look bad. One of the bad things about it was there was a large contingent of perhaps 3 or 4 dozen people had Bernie signs, were yelling Bernie, 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 Bernie. Yep. So now on the Facebook page for the Bernie speech this afternoon here in Champaign at 3 o'clock at the University of Illinois, there's a Trump troll on there. Oh, what we Trump people, you know. It's just, but it has all the earmarks of this being, this is like his Reichstag fire. He's going to be the victim of this. Sandra, I just remembered a third pledge. Sorry, folks, rough segue. Sandra's in here. That means it's time to pitch. We have one from show founder Peter Miller.
All right. Thank you, Peter.
We have one from my dear friend, John, former union school teacher. And we have one from my dear sister, Glenna.
Well, thank you, everybody, for supporting the World Labor Hour and WFT Community Radio.
No any amounts on those? We'll put them in.
Well, I
even,
no, okay.
Even,
I can
without
do...
those, we're at $12,835.
Okay, add that would be $250.
All right. I can't do
Sorry.
That math off the top of my head.
$13,085.
Okay, so if you're listening out there, please, if you haven't pledged yet, please call in at 217-359-9338. That's 217-359-9338. Help keep the World Labor Hour and Community Radio on the air here in Central Illinois.
All right. So, yes, call 359-9338 now and kick it over $14,000 during the labor hour. We can do it.
Okay. And, Gus, there was something else that happened locally, right?
Yes. This was a really amazing event that happened yesterday on the campus. Big shout out to the Campus Faculty Association. This is the tenured union on the campus. So these are the tenured professors and their union. They put together a great rally protest speak out event that brought down professors, students, community members from Chicago at Chicago State, from Eastern Illinois University, from Southern Illinois University. And we're talking about 12 different groups of people that spoke about what the budget crisis is doing to the state of Illinois and how we are all one united oppressed group. So it was a really amazing coalition event that's going to spark something big that we're talking about possibly doing more events afterwards. I was the MC for the event and we had members from the university. We had my group. We had Karen from Black Students Revolution spoke and gave an amazing speech that's going all over YouTube right now. We had these great students from Chicago State University who, as those listeners will know, have actually received their layoff notices and the possibility that they may close by the end of this month. And they were talking about all the different things they're trying to organize there to stop this from happening. So it was really just a lot of different people, campus and community together, all over the state coming to one area. About 300 people came out. I mean, it was just a really amazing thing that needs to be done, and we have to continue to do it.
Oh, indeed, yes. Yeah. That's great. I'm glad to hear that and everything.
Yeah.
Okay, some other quick news stories here. Once again, Greece is in the throes of domestic unrest, despite the fact that global solidarity movements and the corporate media have seemingly forgotten about Greece following last July's referendum. In recent weeks, Greeks have been taking action. Farmers have set up roadblocks in hundreds of locations throughout Greece and have descended upon the capital. battle. Lawyers are on strike. Accountants have declared they will abstain from filing tax returns for their clients. And ordinary citizens have once again filled the streets in protest of the series of government's proposed pension cuts, recapitalization of the banks, and tax increases on regular working people.
And by the way, wasn't Syriza supposed to be the savior left-wing party?
Yes.
And
they sold out. They sold out. The popular stoppage of payments movement, which was founded in Crete in 2013, has inspired similar social movements throughout Greece since its inception. Each week, members of the movement block local courthouses, preventing the auctions of foreclosed homes from taking place and saving these homes for their owners in the process. Anyway, and then we've got some story here from France. Tens of thousands of people protested across France on Wednesday against President François Hollande's determination to achieve what his conservative predecessor didn't even try to dare to do, which was tamper with a 35-hour work week.
By the way, isn't he a socialist?
Yes, supposedly. Workers, unemployed, youth joined forces on Wednesday answering calls from student organizations and unions in more than 200 cities across France to try to kill the bill. Paris police said between 27 and 29,000 protesters took to the streets in Paris, and various unions quoted by local media put the estimate much higher, between 80 and 100,000. And the contested attack on working conditions would amend France's 35-hour work week, approved in 2000 by the socialist government and now a cornerstone of the left-wing parties. But the current socialist government, which has seems like it's sold out to neoliberalism, wants adjustments to reduce France's 10% supposedly to reduce 10% unemployment rate, as a shortened work week was meant to do. So yes.
I'm glad we're talking about this and why and this Bernie Sanders thing is big now and mm-hmm. which in the news stories you just read. You know, this past couple of years, for those that have been listening, we've been talking about different areas of Europe where the socialist governments have taken power and have led to many austerity measures. One of the best books for those listening out there reading, I know Jim knows about this book, is Frantz Fanon's Wretched of the Earth.
Oh, yes.
And one of the best things about the book is that he critiques and complicates what socialism is, and there is a differentiation between the socialism that takes part in parts of Europe and other groups of social and other groups of socialism that come from the people themselves, particularly in non-European countries, mm-hmm. and how they differentiate. And we're seeing how Fanon was already talking about this stuff in the 60s
yeah.
coming to fruition, because we have this old school traditional socialist ideology that really is very oppressive, in that people don't understand that it has to. It's so much to go over on this stage, but just read the book and just knowing that we've seen these stories for this past year of these groups coming about and claiming to be socialists, when in fact they have a different type of socialist that is not about the people's democracy and self-determination. I mean, that's something that people really need to start thinking about. Now that socialism is becoming a more common term, now we have to complicate it.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot of different types of socialism.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I suggested to someone who I had just met the other day, we were talking, got into some politics, and I suggested that she go make sure she was registered as a Democrat and go vote for Bernie Sanders in the primary. And this person is a union member, however, belonging is a government employee, and did and the only reason she joined the union was so she could get cheaper insurance.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Number one, her union is not doing a very good job of educating her, mm-hmm. obviously. Okay. And she goes, "Well, I wouldn't do that." And I said, "Why not?" She goes, "Well, he's a socialist." And I said, "Well, what's a socialist?" He goes, "Well, they're communists." And I said, "What's a communist?" She goes, you know how that goes. You know, it's just so many people, they don't really, it's just they get these words in their heads. She's been hearing this her whole life.
Yeah, propaganda.
You know?
Yeah.
And,
yeah, which I think we should do a show on what socialism is. And I would love to just come in and do a breakdown of different types of socialism for our listeners.
That'd be great.
We really need to get this clear.
We got to do this in
perhaps
April for sure.
Perhaps we get someone from the Socialist Forum, a local group.
We could do that too. Okay, real quick, an enormous group of underpaid Floridians bursted through police lines in Miami Thursday evening on their way to the GOP, the Republican debate, where they're calling on the candidates to stand with the nearly 4 million Floridians who make less than $15 an hour, chanting, "We work, we sweat, put $15 in our checks." The group stormed through the University of Miami campus and up to the front gate of the Bank United Center as stunned Republican debate goers looked on. The crowd of hundreds forced police to shut down Ponce de Leon Avenue, the main street in front of the debate venue, menu. Early in the day on Thursday, fast food workers across Miami also walked off their jobs calling for $15 an hour and union rights. And lastly here, Dr. Quentin Young, one of the most extraordinary leaders in the Medicare for All single-payer movement and a founding member of both Physicians for a National Health Program and Healthcare Now, has died at the age of 92. Dr. Young was a founding member of the Committee to End Racial Discrimination in Chicago Medical Institutions, which during the 1950s fought for integration of hospitals and awarding staff privileges to African-American physicians. The Committee to End Racial Discrimination is also involved in the Chicago branch of the Medical Committee for Human Rights, the medical arm of the Civil Rights Movement, about which John Dittmer has written Extraordinary History of the Good Doctors. Dr. Young was a medical volunteer for the Mississippi Freedom Project in 1964, served as the national chairman of this organization from 67-68. In 1968, Dr. Quentin Young was summoned before the notorious House Un-American Activities Committee, which was trying to connect the medical committee to the Communist Party. He refused to answer whether he was a communist and repeated his belief that the House Un-American Activities were unconstitutional. Dr. Young served as president of the American Public Health Association in 1998, was a private physician of Barack Obama and Studs Terkel, and cared for Dr. Martin Luther King when he was injured by throwing rocks during a Chicago march. Dr. Young, 2 years ago, published an extraordinary autobiography, Everybody In, Nobody Out, Memoirs of a Rebel Without a Pause. So,
Dave, yes. I would like to add that Dr. Young was, I believe, the first guest on the Labor Hour.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting historical fact, Bill.
And I believe that that took place in the back studio that time.
So that had been back in like 1995, early 96.
Yeah, that's okay. Correct. And I got something I'd like to bring up here. Let me see if I can find it. I'm hating my computer. Here we go. It's an article called Front Porch Focus Group Explores Appeal of Trump's Right-Wing Message, and it's basically a press release from Working America. And a new Working America report finds that key white working class voters have not made their minds up yet in the 2016 presidential race, but of those who have, Donald Trump is the strongest choice. The unique Front Porch Focus Group report uses qualitative and quantitative data from 1,689 face-to-face conversations held over 5 weeks in Ohio. The report found that Trump drew more supporters than all other GOP candidates combined, and was also the choice of 25% of Democrats with a candidate preference. I'll just come down to the main point so I can quit reading so fast. A large portion of voters remain undecided, with 53% yet to choose a candidate. Trump was favored by more than a third of those who chose a candidate, and that's 38% of people. Party loyalty did not determine candidate choice as much as expected. While most of Trump's support came from a staunch GOP base, 1 in 4 Democrats who chose a candidate showed preference for him, and 58% of his backers said they would support him as an independent. Thoughtful conversations with trusted messengers can move voters, folks. This is it. One conversation is worth 10,000 campaign commercials. Can move voters away from right-wing populism to a different take on the issues, providing them with an independent source to help them through the deluge of information through a unique communications channel, that is, face-to-face engagement, is critical to that evolution. You know, I've been turning personal things in my life into pitches for policy. You know, you got to do that. Take people you know. Say, look at this person here. How could that person get along without this? Mm-hmm. Or what could we do more for that person? Bring those into conversations. And
yeah, that's a good point, Bill.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah. Do we have time for one more story?
I think, Angela, you had something, right?
Go ahead. I do have something.
Okay, well, let's do Angela's, and then we'll do yours, Gus, and then we'll be going on to our guest here.
Sure. Yes, I was looking at this truthandaction.org, and it has an interesting story about FEMA.
Okay, the Federal Emergency Management. Oh, yeah, the FEMA trailers in during Katrina, yes.
Yes.
Long before that. Heck of a job, Brownie.
No, this is about FEMA camps, correct?
Yeah.
Right, but I'm making an association.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, these things have been going on for a long time. A lot of people have been talking about them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Look, they have ordered $1 billion worth of disposable coffin outliners, 14 million body bags, and 140 million long life meals, or MREs. And it says, is this the anticipation of a natural disaster? In anticipation of a massive civil unrest? Or does all of this seem to be far out there to be believed? But that's a lot of ordering of body bags and coffin outliners, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, unless they got rid of all their stock and is replacing it, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, I can't remember when it was, but several years ago, a lot of these camps were built back then, and now they're stocking them.
Mm-hmm.
But why did they build the camps in the first place, and why are they stocking them? For some civil disorder? I don't know. Maybe they're anticipating the Donald Trump campaign.
World War III.
But it depends on who you're talking to. If you're talking to a right-winger, they're going to say it's to put people with guns in such a way. If you talk to somebody on the left, it's probably to put immigrants away, is what a lot of people on the left say. And then, you know, some others have some other ideas about dissidents in general being put away in these camps.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's still interesting. Your take on it, Gus?
This is a story that's been actually going around for a few years now.
Uh-huh.
I think this is the second or third time this has happened. And right after Katrina is when the first story broke about this ordering of all these different coffins and liners, et cetera. The one thing about our country, particularly that people forget, is that we do have a policy of martial law that is in place if need be. And because of the things that have been happening, not just globally, but also nationally in relation to, you know, things like what happened in Chicago yesterday, you know, and just this violent rhetoric and action that's been caused by a lot of the political discourse, then you can definitely see them preparing, particularly after the Baltimore Rebellion and a few other instances of the oppressed actually asking for democracy through violent rebellion. Mm-hmm. So I can definitely see them trying to prepare for something larger happen because, like I said, the government is not, I mean, not the government, but the capitalists are not capitalists because they're stupid. You know, they understand, they understand that there is a growing anger and disillusionment amongst working people across race, gender, sexuality, and across transnational lines that something is deeply wrong with the structure of the way our political economy operates.
You
can feel it coming.
Yes,
so, you know, like I said, they're not dumb. They see these things and they have, you know, spies and subversive people in groups. So they know that something is brewing that is years down the line, just like during the Russian Revolution, the American Revolution. They can feel something coming.
Yes.
So that's what I get from
them. Okay. Or could this be simply some crony contractor that somebody in FEMA.
There you go.
Okay.
It doesn't sound like it's for anything good.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It can't be good.
Okay. So we're going to turn to our guest. We're a very special guest in the studio, Dan Lynn. Dan, welcome to the World Labor Hour.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Okay. So you're basically, tell us a little about yourself and why you're here today.
Sure. So my name is Dan Lynn. I'm the executive director of the Illinois chapter of NORML, which is the National Organization to Reform Marijuana Laws. I also serve as the national policy director for Phoenix Botanicals and Phoenix Farms of Illinois, which is going to be opening up a medical cannabis dispensary in Champaign, probably in early April. We're looking to do an event at the Champaign Public Library on March 20th from 2 to 4 p.m. to educate the community about our company, the benefits of medical cannabis, the Illinois Medical Cannabis Pilot Program, and how patients can enroll in that program.
Okay, and that dispensary is going to be at 1704 South Neal Street, Suite C?
Yeah, we're still finishing the construction there. I saw the guys over there doing some concrete on the sidewalk this morning because it will be a handicap accessible building. Once when we get through the construction build out, we'll need to pass a couple of state inspections, and hopefully we'll pass those inspections. Then we'll get our employees registered with the state. There is a little bit of a delay with the background checks and fingerprinting that the state makes us go through as employees. And then we're looking to do a public open house where the public can come to the dispensary, view the operation, see, you know, who we are, what we're about. And then after that, we'll have a grand opening for patients. Once when we start selling medicine to patients, both the public and the media will not be allowed in the facility.
Okay. And so, what, conditions do people in Illinois, what are they legally able to get a prescription for marijuana for?
There's 39 specific qualifying conditions that patients must have in order to qualify for this medicine. There is a way for more conditions to be added. There's two mechanisms, one through petitioning the Medical Cannabis Advisory Board. However, as we've seen twice now, the director of the Department of Public Health ultimately has the ability to reject all of those approved conditions that are being petitioned. We've seen that happen twice now. The second mechanism for adding conditions is through the General Assembly, where we actually were successful in adding not just epilepsy and seizure disorders to this program, but also minors, which was not a part okay. of the original bill that was passed into law.
Well, what I noticed, I don't know what all 39 conditions are, because I've never actually seen them listed anywhere. But I was under the impression that it was nowhere near as there were nowhere near as many conditions possible in Illinois as there are, say, in California or Colorado or in a lot of other states. We're very limited. You have to be really pretty messed up.
Yeah, if you're looking for that list of the 39 qualifying conditions, the state of Illinois has set up a website for the program, which is mcpp.illinois.gov, and Illinois is spelled out. In California, they trust their doctors that are licensed to write these recommendations for any condition that the doctor's professional opinion thinks would be helpful in treating with medical
cannabis.
That's
like with most about every other medicine, correct?
Yeah, you can always write off-label prescriptions for other medications.
Yeah, I know people who get SSRIs, you know, like Zoloft and all those things from their, you know, doctors that have nothing to do with psychology or psychiatry.
Exactly. And with the Illinois program, one of the things that's pretty evident with those 39 conditions that the lawmakers over the 10 years that we debated this legislation was they wanted conditions that were extremely verifiable. They didn't want patients to be able to show up at their doctor's office, claim to have some condition that the doctor couldn't prove one way or the other, and then get access to this. Over the 10 years of working on this legislation, the biggest opponents to it were the law enforcement community, as well as some family values oriented groups, which, you know, it's pretty disgusting when a family values group doesn't want to have a natural medicine available to those who aren't getting relief from the pharmaceutical drugs.
I would question that label family values. I mean, frankly, you know, there's a lot of children that have conditions, I guess, leukemia or whatever is in which medical
epilepsy
marijuana.
And epilepsy. And many things. And, and some of these things can be treated without the highness part of the pot, the THC. There's CBD oil is very
You know, looking at the science behind medical cannabis, all mammals, all humans have an endocannabinoid system. Whether or not they've ever consumed cannabis to begin with, what they're learning about this endocannabinoid system is that it modulates other systems in the body, like the cardiovascular system, the digestive system, the central nervous system. And there are two receptors that they've been able to identify, the CB1 receptor and the CB2 receptor. And in the cannabis plant, there are these compounds known as cannabinoids that there's about 75 of them that they've identified so far. The one that everybody seems to know about is THC, which is the one that has the psychoactive component. And now the new kid on the block is CBD, which has a lot of the medical benefits without the psychoactive components. And that's really the one that people have been looking for and looking to really maximize production of. But for decades of illegal underground cannabis cultivation, it was always about maximizing the THC because, as we've seen with any other type of prohibition, you're always looking to increase potency because that's where the real value is in those products. Now that we're starting to take this market out of the illegal sector, bring it above the table, we're starting to have cultivators that are actually looking to produce high CBD strains of cannabis because just like with tomatoes or grapes, there's different strains of cannabis that have these different cannabinoid profiles, which can be useful for treating different symptoms of different diseases. And the thing about THC and CBD is that they're inversely related in the cannabis plant. So the higher the THC, the lower the CBD, and vice versa. The lower the THC, oftentimes the higher the CBD.
Well, are they antagonistic towards each other in terms of, I guess, effect?
There is some supporting data that somebody who's have too much THC could take a little bit of a CBD oil or a CBD vaporizer pen and
reduce
that.
Too much THC?
There are people, especially with edibles, where they'll have, you know, they'll consume an edible.
Maureen
they haven't felt any effects for 15 minutes, so they eat another edible. And then in an hour and a half, they're having a bad experience.
Yeah.
A lot of this depends on how familiar they are with using cannabis. Anyways.
And I would direct people to look up Maureen Dowd, the New York Times, the very famous New York Times reporter. She went out to Colorado a few months ago and got something. And they must not have told her what to do with it, or she didn't pay attention, and she ate way too much.
Ah.
And nothing bad happened, but she was a little bummed out for a while.
Okay.
Because she had never, gotten high before in her life.
I see.
And she's in her 50s.
Okay.
So it was.
Yeah, that'd be probably a little bit of a shock to the system for sure. I don't know. Did you want to talk a little bit about the history of this as far as how did this, I mean, this was quite a battle getting this medical marijuana law in Illinois, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a 10-year legislative fight. The original sponsor of this legislation was State Representative Larry McKeon, who was a gay man with AIDS who would testify about how his lover died of wasting syndrome. Well, Larry McKeon died about 6 years ago from one of these qualifying conditions. And it was interesting that you brought up Dr. Quentin Young at the top of the show. Dr. Quentin Young was also the personal physician to former Governor Pat Quinn and was instrumental in getting Governor Quinn to be supportive of medical cannabis when he was in office.
Interesting.
Yeah, and was it Young? Was he associated with Obama too?
He was his personal doctor for a while.
Oh, did you say that in the story?
Yes, I did. So it was like a 10-year battle, and I remember reading stories about this occasionally in the newspaper, and I know for a while there it was just a vote or two shy, and then it finally broke the threshold.
Yeah, and if you look at, you know, what we had to do in order to really compromise this legislation to make it be politically feasible, originally we were going to allow patients or their caregivers to grow 12 plants. We reduced that down to 8 and then down to 6, and 6, but only 3 could be mature. Eventually we had to take out the ability for cultivation for patients or caregivers. Now they have to, all the medicine has to be cultivated at one of 21 licensed cultivation centers, which is one for each state police district in Illinois. At one time, there was going to be a cap on how many patients could participate in this program. We kind of knew that if that was ever going to be tested, we could probably win in court by fighting it with just an arbitrary number. And then the pilot program aspect was something that we also had to include to pass this. Nobody wants to see this medicine be taken away from the patients who are benefiting from it. Nevertheless, in order for it to be politically feasible, we had to put this type of sunset clause or trial period attached to it, and that was something that we're now starting to struggle with because we're 2 years into this four-year pilot program. Medicine has only been available since November, and a lot of the people in the medical cannabis industry really need to start working the political process to make sure that this program is not only extended but made permanent so that we don't have to be worried about taking this medicine away.
Yeah, just another example of Illinois Democrats being good 1950s Eisenhower Republicans. God, I tell you, this state has been dominated.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if they would have done something better on this, that might have kept Ron her out, but they just
I know. Yes, indeed, Bill. So how does Illinois' medical marijuana law compare to other states that don't have full legalization? I mean, is it pretty restrictive compared to other states?
For a long time it was touted as the most restrictive program in the country. I would question that label now, because if you look at New York's medical cannabis program, they don't allow for any smokable forms of medical cannabis. It's only the edibles and the tinctures and the salves. So I think that theirs is a little bit stricter than ours. However, ours is somewhat unique in that we require patients to go through fingerprinting and a background check in order to qualify for this. If you have any type of felony drug conviction or a violent crime conviction on your background, you aren't allowed to participate in this program.
Really? Even though you have the medical condition?
Yeah, and that's something where you could be a convicted murderer, convicted rapist, have cancer, get access to chemotherapy and chemotherapy drugs, get access to Oxycontin, Vicodin. Nevertheless, in Illinois, if you have cancer, you can't get access to medical
cannabis. That is just totally absurd. That is
a drug felony in your background.
Yeah. That is absurd. Absolutely absurd. You know,
and again, this isn't anything that I thought was a great idea.
No,
this was
of course
all
not.
To appease sure. law enforcement and their concerns about having sick people have access to this natural substance.
Yeah, I can't remember what the vote was, but I do know in the last gubernatorial election in this state that there was an advisory resolution passed by, I think it was a pretty good majority, asking the legislature to legalize cannabis.
Mm-hmm. Natural legalization, okay.
And that's when we get this right-wing Republican voted in mm-hmm. at the same time, which is really bizarre. That just shows you how much support you get for legalized cannabis in Illinois.
Okay.
And then they foist this terrible law on us.
Yeah.
Not you foisting it, but then.
Yeah.
So I had a question too for our guest. So with this medical marijuana, will they still have to take the actual medicine for the, you know, for what they have, or can they just do
substitute it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The medical treatment for the patient is going to be unique to the individual and the doctor. You know, we're not saying only take medical cannabis, don't take any other prescription drugs. What we already have seen, though, with a lot of patients is that they've been able to reduce their pharmaceutical intake, which oftentimes improves their quality of life significantly because a lot of these patients are taking a pharmaceutical drug to combat the side effects of another pharmaceutical drug.
Exactly.
And we don't have those same type of detrimental side effects or even long-term usage problems like with people's livers or kidneys being damaged because of the opioids that they're forced to take for long-term pain treatment.
Exactly. I mean, people always want to put this into the context of a morality issue in relation to cannabis, marijuana. But there's our guest just brought up an extremely important point in that you are often taking multiple drugs to combat the issues of other pharmaceutical drugs that you're dealing with. And that makes a lot of profit for the medical industry, and which is why there's been such a nasty fight to keep medical marijuana out of parts of the country. But now again, like you said, a very small part of it is morality, but we have to really start talking about those pharmaceutical effects and why this is such a major improvement on hopefully the health of working, particularly working people in this country.
Well, there's another one too. It's not just countering effects of other ones. Now they've come out with this Abilify, and it's sort of like, well, if you've built up a resistance to Prozac, here, take this pill too.
There was that scene from the Michael Moore film Sicko when he took some of the 9/11 rescue workers that had medical conditions down to Cuba. And I guess this one woman was on 8 different medications, including an inhaler. And I guess that when the doctors examined her and ran all these tests down there over a course of, I guess, several days, they took her off 6 of the 8 medications. And we're going to phase her off one of them over time so that she'd be left with one medication. So, you know, here we go. I mean, it's also just making profit, making money, you know. Even though a lot of cases, I'm sure there is a medical need for, you know, like you said, as far as building resistance or counteracting the effects of another, heavy-duty pharmaceutical drug. So, okay, so, Dan, what's the future hold? I mean, you're talking about this pilot program we're already 2 years into. What's going to happen then here in the next 2 years at the end of the four-year pilot program?
Well, we already have about 5,000 patients registered in this program who now have access to this medicine safely and legally. Some of them were getting this through the underground market and dealing with the criminal element. Now they have a better option to get access to this medicine. All of the medicine that they're getting is tested and has quality controls over it. We've seen reportedly $250 million invested in Illinois in the medical cannabis industry. They've already created hundreds of jobs. And it's not just, you know, creating these jobs and these industries in Chicago or the suburbs of Chicago. The way that the law was written was that there was going to be one cultivation center for each state police district, which is spread out across the state. And then you have these up to 60 dispensaries also equally distributed throughout the state. And one of the things that I think is very interesting is that you had a lot of Republican lawmakers vote against medical cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as the bill passed, they had a lot of their constituents, especially farmers in rural communities, who wanted to get in on this industry because they see this as a growing, as a very profitable potential industry.
Yeah.
Well, as a matter of fact, there was somebody who wanted to start growing out by the jail that Dave helped build in Piatt County, otherwise known as the Piatt County Public Safety Building. And they thought it was a really good idea because it was right next to the jail, but they got rejected.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but I mean, if you look at the potential for profitability in not just medical cannabis, but recreational cannabis, it's tough to find a cash crop that fetches the type of prices that cannabis does. I mean, we're talking in a legal and regulated market, $200 to $400 an ounce, $2,500 to $3,000 a pound. Illinois farmers aren't getting that type of money for a bushel of corn, a bushel of soybeans.
Yes.
Other than things like saffron, you really just don't find that type of a price tag for that amount of any type of crop.
Yes, and how do you know off the top of your head how much tax revenue Colorado has brought in since legalization there?
I believe last year was somewhere between $70 and $90 million.
$70 and $90 million, and not to mention the savings from less people in prison and jail. Less prison guards, less law enforcement, less all that.
Oh, yeah, and not to mention the jobs that are being created.
And the jobs
created,
yes.
I don't think that there is an industry knocking on the door in Illinois like there is with the cannabis industry. You know, these people want to create jobs. You talk to young people, they want to work in this industry. And, oh, by the way, Phoenix Botanicals is hiring, so if people are interested in getting a job with us, check out our website, phoenixbotanical.net. But that's where, you know, I talked to a lot of concerned parents who, you know, they were alive in the 60s. They're willing to admit that they smoked a lot of pot. they inhaled. But now they have a teenager or a young adult child who they're concerned about their cannabis usage. And they tell me, you know, while they didn't get arrested, they don't think that it should be legal still. How can they deal with their child or their teenager that's now starting to experiment with this substance? And I tell them, I mean, go ask your college kid that is smoking pot if they could get a job working at a cultivation center or in the cannabis industry, if they would take that job. Because a lot of young people want to work in this industry. They see it as an exciting new field. Mm-hmm. It's something that is probably 10 or 15 or 20 years from now going to be a very big deal in this country. So get in on the ground floor.
Yeah. Cetera.
All right, so just want to encourage all the Labor Hour listeners to call in. Bob Pelosi's standing by on the phone, so he's a regular voice here, and he's waiting for your call. We're at over 13,000, so that's really exciting news for us here that we're on our way to our $30,000 mark. And wanted to just ask Dan, how many other places have invited you on four times in a week to talk about this?
none. I'm still waiting for those invitations.
Well, WDWS.
I dropped off one of the flyers for that. They said they were going to put it on their news. Like I said, I haven't got any invitations, but we definitely did reach out.
It's no wonder. It really is no wonder. You're talking about things that are talking about pushing the envelope, you know, and anti-establishment, and it's important that we have a place that we can talk about this. I've learned so much from the interviews that we've done here, and to just demystify this whole situation and every situation that you guys work with, you know, to just really call out the truth. And I know our listeners, we had somebody just drop off $5 that he just came by, and he said he listens every single week. He dropped by with his son, who was in a Superman outfit. He said his superpower is giving to weft. There you go.
Okay. All right.
So go to our Facebook page and check that out. Like our Facebook page. You can find out where to donate there, but you know, to call 359-9338 and weft.org. We're looking for donations there. So we're over 13,000. We're trying to hit at least $1,000 a day. The Labor Hour could push us over that, and let's get to 14,000.
By the way, I don't know how much this is worth, but I am pledging a 2002 Ford Focus station wagon that needs a transmission.
Okay.
But you can do that too, folks. You can go to the website and you can see where to donate that piece of crap that's despoiling your property right now.
Okay. All right. So, Dan, any last things you wanted to talk about to our listeners before we have to transition here?
I would like to hear more about the jobs.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, okay. You might get somebody apply from this show.
Yeah. Right now, we're not sure how many patients are going to be registered to our dispensary, so we're looking to hire somewhere between 5 and 10 part-time employees. Once when we get a better idea of what the amount of patients that are coming in and how much they're spending on each visit, we're hoping to make those all full-time employees with some type of benefit package. And then obviously, if we can expand this industry and open up other stores and you know, broaden it, I think that we could create a lot more jobs.
And when it spreads, Bill, which union would be
I think the laborers could do it.
Oh, no, it'd be United Food and Commercial Workers. Or maybe
it is the United Food and Commercial Workers.
Is it really?
They have a division for medical cannabis employees.
No,
how about the IWW?
Actually, I was going to say
the International Workers of the Weed. We could be that, too.
Okay.
Oh, wait. You know, I'm thinking of retiring. I could use a part-time job, but I'm not sure if I could pass the background check.
Oh, so. Okay. Well, Dan, thank you so much for coming on the World Labor Hour, and best of luck to you and everything in this new endeavor. And I agree. I think this is a growth industry, no pun intended. I think this is part of, you know, with all
also green.
With all the parts, you know, everything going on in the country and the state as far as, it's really not a budget crisis, it's a revenue crisis. I mean, this is something we need along with alternative energy to boost the economy. And I think it's great that you're a pioneer in this. Here locally.
Well, here's another thing too, and not just hemp, but other weed, like medical weed. The more that you can grow it outside in the open, the more carbon you take out of the atmosphere and replace with oxygen.
Okay,
there you go. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you very much. Okay, you're listening to the World Labor Hour, listener-supported community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. We're going to take a quick music break, and stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You paint me pictures that fade so fast.
Okay, we're back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour. Let's support community radio station WTN Champaign. We're in pledge drive, so please, if you're listening and you could, whatever you can afford, please call in at 217-359-9338 and pledge to help keep the World Labor Hour and WFT on the air. You're not going to find programs or guests like we just had on corporate radio. I guarantee you that. So just a quick public service announcement. Tune in today at and every Saturday from 2 to 3 p.m. for Not Another Sports Show. The host, fellow worker Neil Parthen. And that's at 104.5 FM WRFU and online at WRFU.org. And on Sunday and every this Sunday and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6 and at UrbanaPublicTelevision.org. Tune in to Labor's Worldview TV. This Sunday is going to be a show in regards to St. Patrick's Day about James Connolly, who is the Irish Revolutionary we're going to talk about later here in the program. He was involved in the Easter Uprising of 1916, so this is the 100th year anniversary. James Connolly was a very interesting socialist and revolutionary and labor activist that we're going to talk about, like I said, later in the show. And this special we got was from 2010, done with myself and Jim Iman. We also show film clips from the film Michael Collins and The Wind That Shakes the Barley to give a little historical context in you know, film format, if you will. Anyway, next Sunday, March 20th on Labor's Worldview, you can tune in and watch the film footage from when Jill Stein was here in Champaign a week ago Wednesday. So we'll make that announcement again next week. So anyway, Gus, you said you had an interesting story about something in the Pentagon. Let's hear about this.
Yeah, because if you've been listening to the World Labor Hour, we've been talking a lot about the drone problems overseas, the U.S. government drones. And, of course, you all know by now that they did a report that 80% of drone strikes across the globe are non-targets, meaning they're innocent civilians that are hit by these drone strikes. Well, a report was just released yesterday morning from the Department of Defense Inspector General that reveals that for nearly 10 years, the U.S. military has been coordinating the domestic use
of
drones.
So they've been spying on us too.
That's right, with local officials and the National Guard. So this is not some conspiracy YouTube garbage. This is a report that was released online that you can read from the Department of Defense Inspector General. It has done so. They have been developing this program domestically without any public accountability or reporting by the media. The Pentagon report prepared last month was made public. It was made public last week amongst different people after a Freedom of Information Act request by the Federation of American Scientists. So they got FOIA'd. Without this FOIA report, then this would have continued without people knowing about it. So this FOIA actually exposed this happening. The Inspector General report provides only a glimpse into the extensive use of the military within the borders of the United States. It refers to less than 20 instances since 2006 when drones were requested by U.S. agencies for use outside of military bases. It does not include a complete list of cases where drones were used, but instead provides 9 examples occurring between 2011 and 2016 where U.S. agencies asked for drone usage. So there's actually more that are not in that report.
That
another FOIA is probably coming to get that information. But again, that's why the FOIA is one of the tactics that can be used, because we would not have known about this
without this FOIA. So while the report is accompanied by the usual reference to, quote, protecting the Americans' public civil liberties and privacy rights, end quote, the use of drones is really a serious warning for everyday people. It is part of a broader expansion of domestic military activity over the past 15 years and complements much more extensive deployment of drone aircraft by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So again, like I said, several of these examples listed include large-scale training exercises that involve a simulated natural disaster within the U.S. borders. Such exercises provide an opportunity for the military to practice the coordination of its assets with local, state, and federal civilian agencies. So again, this is all, this kind of ties to what Angela's story was talking about, that you actually have preparations for things. And we know for a fact that there are different cities in this country that have acquired drones.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're hearing from this report that they're actually have been used.
Already been used.
And mm-hmm. we're waiting for more FOIAs to come out, Freedom of Information Act inquiries to come out to talk about when these drones have been used, because there are a couple of incidents that have happened over the past year or so where, you know, stuff wasn't reported correctly. So we may actually see drone usage ramp up in terms of what happened the past couple of years. So this is scary stuff.
Yeah.
So for people who don't know what drones are, what are drones exactly?
Yeah, drones are basically are non-piloted aircraft that are controlled via remote control from some control center. You know, so it's basically like when you were a kid and you had one of those mm-hmm. planes you were flying around, you know, with the remote control. Well, the kids don't play with those anymore, unfortunately. You know, the kids don't have any fun toys anymore.
I think that needs to be a hobby that people need to start taking up again.
Yeah.
In mass.
Exactly.
So we can, fly around some of those drones perhaps with our little model planes. That'd exactly. be kind of interesting. But seriously, drones can be as large as a small aircraft or as small as like a volleyball or even, you know,
exactly.
flatter, you know.
Yeah, they can be very tiny and most of them do contain ammunition. So, you know, and that's what happens with a lot of overseas drone strikes. You have them targeting so-called terrorist organizations or an individual that is a suspected terrorist, and they end up just shooting up an entire area or neighborhood and killing mostly innocent civilians. So again, like I said, the use of drones and also too, the talk last year about Amazon using drones to
yes.
deliver packages.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some ridiculous report about drones delivering pizzas and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
wow. I tell you, man, almost all the photographers and video people are now buying drones.
Really?
Around here. Yeah. Most of the production companies have been using them for weddings. Flyovers or just whatever they want to see. I don't know if there's going to be any regulation about this before long.
Mm-hmm.
But the only problem I have with them is pretty much the only ones you can get reasonable price at all would just be those little bitty GoPro cameras
mm-hmm.
instead of something really nice.
Hmm.
But yeah, it's amazing how this technology is spurred and it's
yeah, you know,
other ideas
yeah.
too.
Gus, in relation to what you were saying about the stories about Amazon wanting to use those for delivery, I mean, can you imagine? I can't. If you're going to have thousands of these small yeah. delivery drones flying all over the place, I mean, it's going to be
crazy
problems. I would think.
Besides the loss of jobs,
yeah, indeed.
That brings me back to that movie iRobot.
Oh,
and you know what?
Based on the
they're
classic,
not just making up these movies for no reason.
Based on the classic television show, The Outer Limits. Based on that episode, iRobot from The Outer Limits, the show I've been talking.
Asimov.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Wrote this short story, but that the movie was a remake of the original Outer Limits episode, iRobot, with Leonard Nimoy.
Okay. Well, listen, we just got a message from Bob Plessy, who's manning the phone.